Welcome to the Gold Standard here on the 440 Sports Network. Game 2 recap, previewing games 3 and 4. The weekend, the Predators have tied the series up at one game apiece as we head back to Nashville, Tennessee. My name is Braden Gall. You can get to me on Twitter.com at Braden Gall. And we, of course, are live on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. So like, share, do all that stuff. If you want to get into the comments, we do appreciate you. And of course, I am alongside Emma Lingen of the Hockey News and Michael Gallagher of Nashville Hockey Now. Good morning. How are we? How are we this morning?
Sleepy, but good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. There it is. That's what it sounds like. That's probably how the Preds locker room sounded, of course, after a game two win. 4-1. We're going to get to all the details of game two. Certainly some huge news breaking before game two with Thatcher Demko not playing for Vancouver. We don't know what his status is for the rest of the series, but it certainly had a huge effect on the game. Although I'll point out, I think Tyler Myers not playing as well had a pretty big factor on the game. So we'll talk about game three. We'll look ahead. We've actually got some time here with a couple of extra days between game two and three. We're going to hit on some of the news that took place around the NHL. Every time I was interested in getting some updates from the studio desk and just sort of discussion about the Predators Canucks series, all I saw was Artemi Panarin hitting TJ Oshie over and over and over again, and PK Subban and Mark Messier arguing the entire night, and Mark Messier, of course, having nothing to say about anything the entire time. So we're going to give you some good Canucks and Predators talk here on the show. We're going to talk about the game. We're going to talk about UC Saros, how they played. I got some advanced analytics numbers that Predators fans, it's not safe for work, maybe too early in the morning for it. I don't know. Hockey's a crazy game. I just want to ask, first and foremost, because you guys said you're going to judge this team after two games. How do you feel after two games? Because I think you could feel a lot of different things about the way the first two games played out.
Yeah, certainly it's good to get a win, good to get the series tied. It's just interesting, though, because you almost feel like the Predators should have won game one and they should have lost game two. And instead the reverse happened. And, you know, I think it doesn't always have to be pretty, especially this time of year. However, I think that what the Predators did in game two is not going to be a recipe for long-term success, just because, you know, you're going to have guys who are not even able to walk because they're blocking so many shots. So I think that, you know, it was good. It was good, a good response, especially after game one, but definitely I would feel better if we could see a little bit more on offense from the Preds.
Yeah, I agree. We talked about last time that it just felt like Vancouver just executed a little bit better than Nashville did in game one. Last night, they executed a whole lot better than Nashville did. And you almost feel like Vancouver, you wonder just how they ended up losing that game, especially with a 4-1 final score. I think having Casey DeSmith in there as opposed to Thatcher Demko long-term will kind of be not the determining factor in the series, but it'll definitely be something to watch for, because last night we saw Nashville didn't really test Casey DeSmith much at all. When you have a backup goaltender in there, and I know people were in my mentions and all over social media talking about the Predators' notorious track record with backup goaltenders, which isn't great, and rightfully so. They should be pissed off about that. But like Emma said, it almost feels like the Preds should have won game one, the Canucks should have won game two. It's reversed. Now you come back to home ice, you're in this thing, especially if there's going to be a backup goaltender for multiple games in there. So this could be an opening. This, you know, last night certainly wasn't pretty, but it's the kind of win that you can probably build off of a little bit. But I think my biggest takeaway is the defensive zone play. It's been horrible. They can't clear a puck. The entire third period felt like a Vancouver power play. Like, if UC Saros is great, and I wrote about this on Nashville Hockey Now, like, he was great, and that's the kind of performance you're going to need from him, but you can't expect him to do that every game. You have to help him out. The goal that Vancouver scored happened on a screen. That's been an issue for them. Just a lot of issues that need to be fixed is what I took away from last night.
Joe in the comments says, Preds Facebook, referring to Messier as the bald guy, was perfectly Preds Facebook. As a kid who grew up a Rangers fan, like, Mark Messier means a lot to me as a kid, like growing up as a Rangers fan. He's a big deal in my household. My father still texting me about, the Rangers winning the President's Trophy and stuff like that. You're on television to have a take, Mark. So I think you guys are right. And this is what hockey is such. You know, I've been watching, again, as I alluded to, like, I was a Leach, Richter, Graves, Messier kid growing up. Like that those teams in the early 90s for the Rangers was the teams I grew up watching. So I've been watching hockey since the early 90s. And in 30 years of watching hockey, you still are sort of, it never ceases. The game never ceases to amaze me. And honestly, if right now I had not watched any of the two games, like you could tell me right now that the Predators are like, should be up 2-0. I'd be like, okay. If you told me right now that Vancouver should be up 2-0, I'd be like, yeah, you're right. Like they're both lucky, but like both unlucky at the same, like Vancouver was clearly the better team, but they were trailing in the third period in both games. And that's the way the game goes sometimes. Like that's just how it works. Like all these things can be true. You could have the lead for like almost every minute of two games and not be the better team. And it's such a fascinating sport. Like you get a lucky bounce. Like here's the other thing about the first period. I don't know if the two power plays and the amount of ice that was tilted in the first period, like, I don't know if that happens if they don't score the lucky goal, right? Because Vancouver is motivated. They're pissed off. They want to get going. And it never ended after that. Like, it's like they got a lucky goal and then the ice was permanently tilted the rest of the way. And I'll give you some advanced stats here in just a second, but it just never ceases to amaze me that we could be sitting here saying the Preds should be down 0-2 or the Preds should be up 2-0. And like both of them are correct. And it turns out they're 1-1.
Welcome to Nashville Predators hockey, folks.
it's not even just Predators hockey. It's just hockey. Like, it's just the game. It, like, Carolina doing what they did against the Islanders. Like, it's just, the game is bizarre. Okay, part of the reason Vancouver, in my opinion, like, we're all saying, look, the ice was tilted. Vancouver was the better team, et cetera, et cetera. Like, Pettersson is not going to miss that backside goal in the power play ever again in the rest of his life. Like, that's never going to happen. And then how many times does it go off a Saros skate and then off a post? Like they got lucky, but they also made their own luck. And so it's just hard to evaluate. Like if they play like this again, they have no chance in the series. But at the same time, I feel like they have a chance in the series. Now I sound like Mark Messier.
I was just about to say, you're on the radio to have a take, Braden.
I think it's clear that Vancouver's the better team. But I don't know what, like, so outside of UC Saros being really good in the third period, I don't know about you guys, but he made that glove save like 2 minutes into the third. Like, Vancouver shot out of a cannon to start the third period and playing extremely well, to your point, Michael, felt like a power play the entire time. It felt like they parked the bus and were trying to clear the puck from like the 19-minute mark in the third period. UC Saros makes a glove save with like 18 to go. And it was the first time in the game where I thought Vancouver maybe wasn't going to make the comeback. I thought the entire time they would come back because it was just so tilted. And he makes that save, and then he keeps making saves the rest of the way. And then the puck keeps missing the net. And I'm like, okay, maybe it's one of those nights where Vancouver just can't put it in the back of the net. And that's how it worked out.
I think something else we have to talk about, too, is, I mean, the Preds were up 3-0. They gave up Zadorov's goal with like 5 minutes left in the second period. And usually that is the time where this team starts to crumble. You have a multi-goal lead. You let in a goal like that. I mean, Saros was screened. There was nothing he could really do. I think he even said he couldn't even really see the puck because Carrier and another defender were standing in front of him. And you just kind of felt like, oh, okay, here we go again. I've seen this story before. This is the bad luck that this team usually has. And right at the end of a period, it almost just felt like Vancouver is going to come out, start the third period. Things are going to get going. Momentum's going to swing. They're in their home barn, all that stuff. And the Predators, to their credit, you know, held them off the board. Saros stood on his head, made a bunch of great saves. And there was the defensive zone play was an issue, but also like credit to them because the adversity they've been through, they talk about being relentless and the mental toughness and all this stuff. That is a moment that traditionally, for most of this season before in the first 50, 60 games, that would have been the defining moment for Vancouver to come back and stage a comeback. And the Predators held them off. There's a lot of good scores. There's a lot of good players on that Vancouver team and credit to Saros, you know, he made all those ridiculous saves and stuff like that. But I mean, you saw there was a lot of times where the Predators were laboring on shifts because they were out there for 2-3 minutes and they just could not get line changes and stuff like that. All that, they still fought through that and still held Vancouver to just one goal. So I think that's something we gotta talk about too, is usually that's something that would have made this team crumble, and they kind of held on there. And that's really what Andrew Bennett's been preaching for the last, 2-3-4 months.
I would say, I mean, that's certainly true about the defense. I would say specifically, especially in the first period, the penalty killers, my God, like the Preds PK looked very good, like much better than it has in a long time. Granted, Vancouver's power play didn't look great, but still, I mean, the Predators, like they were quick. They didn't give them any space. They kept chipping the puck out. They couldn't, you know, Vancouver didn't have enough time to get set up, and they just looked rattled, and they just got under their skin and frustrated them. And same thing when they had those three penalties in the first period, which a couple of them, I mean, look, I'm not one to complain about officiating.
Dumb penalties.
Yes. But I mean, the officials were calling it tight last night on both sides, I think. But I think that we got to look at, you know, you mentioned the guys being out there for long shifts, not being able to get line changes. That it was the same thing on the penalty kill. I mean, your poor penalty killers were out there for like the entire first period, it felt like. And they, you know, kept the Preds in the game. And yeah, again, I think it's not a long-term recipe for success, because you need to start generating more offense, but and get out of your own zone, which I'm sure Braden will have some fun numbers on that for us. But yeah, I think it got it done. I don't know if it can get it done, you know, for a 7-game series, but got it done last night.
Because I want to piss off Pred social media, can we give Cole Smith a hand? 5 minutes and 14 seconds on the penalty kill. Yeah. He was blocking shots. He almost took a skate to the face. Like, the dude was out there busting his ass. And I think, granted, he didn't show up on the scoreboard, but I think he was probably one of the most noticeable players for the Predators on the ice last night.
He didn't take a skate. He took a boot to the face. Like, he got like that. You rarely see the side of, and thank goodness it's not the blade, obviously, but he takes the side of the skate to the face, which is a very the rare ankle to the face in the NHL.
He had some words for the officials for after that too. So I'm like, that's something you usually see from him.
Well, okay. I'd never thought about this, but like, the stick is an extension of your body. And if the stick comes up and hits you in the face and you bleed, it's automatically a double minor. What's the rule on a skate? I don't understand. He's the one who hit, like, they hit each other. So I don't know how, I actually don't know if he has a gripe with the ref on that or not. Like, can you control where your foot goes when the other player hits you? Is that a penalty? Like, I never thought it was supposed to be a penalty. Did you guys? Not that it matters. I'm just curious.
I don't know. I mean, he could have been arguing maybe that it should have been a cross check or something, you know, that happened before that. I don't know. But I just thought it was funny because he's one of the most like even keel guys on the team. And for him to be yelling, that's like seeing UC Saros yelling at a ref. You're like, whoa.
I'd like to think he was yelling out compliments. Like, you're calling a great game. Like, I just think Cole Smith is just one of the nicest guys ever. So
keep it up, buddy.
Yeah, it's funny to see.
Your lawn looks amazing.
Yeah, it's funny to see him show that rare emotion where he looks pretty pissed off.
All right, so a couple things. You talked power play. I thought the third penalty kill in the first period was extraordinary. They didn't even let him get set up in the zone at all. The first two were not. I agree that the block shot. So this is what I found fascinating about the block shot thing. Ton of credit for the Preds for figuring that part out. And then I think the announcers mentioned this, but in the third period, the Vancouver could not put a puck on the net. And it's clear that them disrupting the shooting lanes for the first 40 minutes, which was really literally the only thing they could do the entire game, was disrupt the shooting lanes. And they did a great job of that. It's clear that that was in Vancouver's head in the third period. They were firing. Like, when Quinn Hughes is missing the net almost every time, something is in his head about that. And Pettersson, of course, a guy who's making $90 million, has got to be a better player if you're Vancouver and the Predators. I kind of are just lucky that he's in this funk right now. But the power play or the penalty kill, and it was Zucker who like slashed Hughes coming through the neutral zone, which again is a dumbass penalty. Like, it's a stupid penalty to take with after giving up the goal after two long shifts and it's 3-1. If Vancouver had scored on that power play, they win the game. Like, I'm convinced of that. If the Predators had given up a goal on that power play, you know, last 2 minutes of the second period, Vancouver, no question, comes back and wins the game in the third period. But I want to go back to your Cole Smith thing, because I do have there's one thing I think I noticed about Brunette in the third period. That line's one of the only lines I trusted to be out there. I sure as hell didn't trust Evangelista and Novak and the rest of those guys to be out there. I trusted McCarron, Smith, and Sherwood. Sherwood, in fact, is the guy who kept Joshua from scoring that goal with the incredible stick check on the backside of Saros. I trusted those guys to be out there, and I thought you could see the trust with Andrew Burnett's decision-making on his deployment in the third period. He puts the second power play unit out there, right, when Philip Forsberg draws the power play with 5 minutes to go. He starts with the second one because he wants his big dogs to finish it and then be on the ice when they have to go back to defensive form. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to say the last shift the Evangelista line had was like 7 or 8 minutes into the game. And he's like, all right, I'm going to get you out there. You're fresh. I'm going to use you guys up. And then I'm going to be going back and forth between lines 1 and 4 the rest of the way. Tommy Novak, I'm not trying to be negative here, but Tommy Novak has, every time he touches the puck, I was like, come on, man. And it's not there. It's not there in the first two games. So I don't know. What did you guys think of it? I thought Andrew Burnett really like sneaky, strategically good deployment of lines in the third period, knowing that they were holding on to a two goal lead, trying to steal one in game two.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you've been seeing it down the stretch here with that, him usually starting games with that fourth line. And there's a reason he calls them the identity line, because they do embody what this team wants to be. They want to be difficult to play against. And, you know, in a game like that one, a game like game two, it was gritty and it was scrappy and it was not pretty. And so that is almost when you want your guys like your McCarrans, your Sherwoods, your Smiths to be out there and really, like I said earlier, be a pest, get under the skin of the opponent, like frustrate them, rattle them, and you know, just kind of keep them away. Because clearly, like you said, Andrew Brunette's got to make that decision, because clearly your offense isn't getting it done. And your offense is not getting it out of the zone. And, you know, they're not generating enough attempts. And so I think it was smart by Brunette to recognize that. Now, I'm sure that is something that will be addressed between now and game three. But within the game, there's not much you can do about it. So I think that that's extremely smart decision making to be like, all right, this is where we're at right now. And we're going to put out the guys, like you said, the guys that we trust, who can actually get under Vancouver's skin, keep them from scoring. And yeah, I think that that's when you need your guys like that. Because, I mean, Brunette's been saying this all year that he really doesn't have, I mean, aside from the first line, he really doesn't have traditional, you know, second line, third line, fourth line, because, I mean, especially when you got your fourth line playing second line minutes, I mean, that it was just that kind of game where you need those guys. Now, if the game had gone differently, you know, if it was a faster, you know, more offensive game, I'm sure we probably wouldn't have seen them as much. But I think it was great decision making within the game to do that.
Yeah, I think if you think about traditional line, you know, numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, you would call the Smith line, you know, the fourth line. But the way Andrew Burnett uses them, they're almost like a second line or a 1B. And I think a part of that is probably by strategy, just because I think when opposing teams see Michael McCarron come over the boards and they see Cole Smith and Kiefer Sherwood, they're like, oh, the fourth line's out there. And sometimes that kind of lulls them into a false sense of security. They rely on that line just as much. It almost reminds me of a couple of years ago when you had the Craig Smith, Nick Bonino. I forgot who the third person on that line was, but that line was going out there and they were just taking it to people. They were killing penalties. They were making it. They were making life difficult for anyone to generate offense. And I forget who the third player was, but that line, that reminds me of the Cole Smith, Sherwood, McCarron line. And when the game is trending the way it is in the third period, when you're going out there and you're basically, you can't get out of your own zone, you need guys like that because you need to win puck battles. You need a 6'7" guy like Michael McCarron to push some people along the boards and separate them from the puck. And I think Andrew Burnett addressed that too. Someone asked him last night in post game, why you had those guys out there so late in crucial points in the third period against, you know, Brock Besser and JT Miller and guys like that. And Andrew Burnett's like, because I trust them. He's like, they've done it for the last 40 games of the year. He's like, they've shown me that, you know, they can play to our identity and kind of limit the chances and do all the things that we want. And I think it's a credit to all three of those. That line just kind of seemed like it formed out of nowhere. Burnett kind of stumbled upon it, and it's been one of the better lines. I mean, obviously, the Forsberg, the top line, has been their best line, but I would argue that the McCarron line has been their second best line.
Well, I would also point out, I mean, this seems minor, but, you know, maybe not in the grand scheme of things, that Brock Besser and Cole Smith were teammates at North Dakota for a couple seasons, and they actually know each other very well. And I think that putting Smith, I mean, there's got to be something to that. Putting Smith out there against a guy that he knows and he's played with and he's familiar with is going to help. Also, just going to throw in here, because Michael got to piss off Preds Twitter and I'm feeling left out, and he took and he took my guy Cole Smith, so I'm gonna also piss off Preds Twitter, because apparently I did this a few weeks ago.
Luke Shen played a great game.
I'm not feeling that spicy today. No, I was gonna say, a couple weeks ago I wrote a story for the Hockey News about why I think Kiefer Sherwood deserves a contract extension after this season, because he is a free agent after this year. Had no idea people were going to react the way that they did. And who knew? People really didn't like him. And so anyway, I'm going to reiterate that. Well, I would say I knew, but I didn't think it was like 2022 Cole Smith level of hate. But I think that, yes, I'm just going to reiterate, with the way that he played last night, the way that he plays with that line, I think he's the kind of guy you need. And if you can get him signed to a team friendly deal, I think that Kiefer Sherwood deserves an extension, and I will now get off my soapbox and wait for people to yell at me.
I think it, outside of the one rush, I think it might have actually been a shorthanded rush where I think it was Smith and McCarron. And, you know, I think Smith sends him a pass that's like, it's a 2-on-1 rush, and like he sends him a pass that's like 3 feet in the air, which of course looks like it's 1 foot in the air when you're Michael McCarron. And he knocks it out of thin air, knocks it down, puts it on his stick, and gets a shot on net. And DeSmith has to like reach behind him to like make sure he doesn't go in. It was almost a goal. Outside of that really high, extremely impressive skill play from that line, this is going to come off as an insult. It's not meant to be, but like every time they try to do something finesse high end, it doesn't work. Like they're not a line that's going to go down and score a bunch of goals and get a bunch of opportunities. That's just not what they are. But to y'all's point about trust, the only time that the puck would go from the Nashville Predators end of the ice into the other end of the ice was when they were on the ice. Like, that's it. The two lines, and I know Sisson's great story, by the way, to point out that Colton Sisson's, of course, getting to score like that against, you know, beating, by the way, totally beat Pettersson to the puck. Like, completely just, to be a BC kid, to score like that against your childhood team, and to be in that situation is really cool. But that line is the only line. I mean, outside of the top line, the only time that the puck even went to the other end of the rink was when they were on the ice. So there's no question that they belonged on the ice in the third period. Joshua Wright says, late to the show, but Braden was 100% right. That's always going to get you onto the show about Dakota Joshua being public enemy number one. Look, when you take a flying, like, Mortal Kombat knee kick into the goaltender, people are going to get upset with you. There's always that guy for every team, for every series, that the other team absolutely despises because of how he's pretty good, but he's kind of annoying. And game one, I was like, that guy's going to piss people off. And then sure enough, game two, he's at it again. So
every series needs a villain.
Yeah. I thought that last night when that happened, because you said that after game one, that Dakota Joshua was going to be the villain. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course, he scored twice in game one. Like, of course, people don't like him. But then
he's talking all kinds of shit.
Oh,
all
yeah. Kinds of shit. And as soon as he went flying into Saros in game two, I was like, well, shit, Braden was right. He's there. And
every now and then.
Yeah.
Every now
Fred's right. Twitter is at its peak when they have somebody to hate. I mean, they thrived when Ryan Johansson told Ryan Kessler that he was a fucking loser and nobody liked him. I think Dakota Joshua is the Ryan Kessler for them. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in game three, because, I mean, luckily Saros, it doesn't look like he was hurt. At least he was downplaying it if he was. But that could have been really bad. I mean, we saw that Thatcher Demko. I mean, game one, it looked like he got hurt on. So, I mean, And as important as UC Saros is to this team, if he would have got hurt on that play, and then you'd be starting Kevin Lankinen, I would hate to see how the fans would treat Dakota Joshua, because, I mean, you're talking about the most important player on the team.
All right. You want some statistics here? Do you guys have you guys looked at the XG numbers, puck offensive zone time, and then possession time in the offensive zone? Have you guys seen the numbers? Have you looked at them? Okay. What do you think? So I'll give you game one. Game one, expected goals, 2.63 for Vancouver, 1.77 for Nashville. I thought they were pretty even until the third period. Vancouver was the better team in the third period. That's how they won the game. I thought both both goaltenders made a couple of big saves, but largely were not asked to do a whole lot in that game. That seems about right. Puck in the offensive zone time. Game number one, 23-49 for Vancouver, 22-37 for Nashville. Okay, about right, but Vancouver better in the last 15 minutes, probably pushed that over the top. Same thing with offensive zone time, possession time in the offensive zone. In game number one, 5 minutes and 44 seconds for Vancouver, 5 minutes and 37 seconds for Nashville. Basically, again, about the same. Vancouver slightly better in every category. Nashville had a lead, even though it looked like Vancouver was slightly the better team, kind of more capable of playing the style of the series. And, of course, the last 15 minutes, they turned it on and won the game. Which brings us to game two. Expected goals for Vancouver Canucks, 3.45 in the game. Nashville Predators, 1.5. That's all you need to know about the score right there. The score was supposed to be 3.5 to 1.5. Vancouver was 2 goals better in expected goals in game two. Puck in the offensive zone. This is actually way better than I expected it to be. 26 minutes and 35 seconds for Vancouver. 21 minutes and 46 seconds for Nashville. Not as bad as I thought, but wait, it gets better. Possession of the puck in the offensive zone. Nashville Predators, 5 minutes and 41 seconds. Okay, about average for a game. It's basically exactly what they did in game one, basically exactly what Vancouver did in game one. Offensive zone possession time for the Vancouver Canucks in game two, 9 minutes and 16 seconds.
There it is.
Almost 1/6 of the game. They had not was the puck in the zone. They were possessing the puck in the zone. It was a shooting gallery for the vast majority of the game. And all that does is kind of reiterate all the things we've said. They need to get more balanced production from their four lines. I don't know. They can't keep taking stupid penalties. They cannot allow. They've got to get the puck out of the zone, and they've got to figure out how to tilt the ice the other direction. I don't know what that means from a lineup change standpoint for games 3 and 4 in the other lines on offense. We were talking about defense after game one. I don't know if there's some consideration here to, like, again, you can't take Tommy Novak or Luke Evangelista off the ice. That's not going to happen. But you got to figure something out here, because you can't have your win the game up by two, grind it out identity line, and then your top scoring line be the only. You need the production from the other two. So I don't know. Do you guys have any lineup changes that you'd like to see from game 3 or 4?
Not really. I don't really think the answer is to. I don't think it's the personnel. Like, I think you have the right guys out there. You just need them to, like, produce. You need them to do what they were doing down the stretch. So, I mean, we talked about after last game, there were a lot of people that were saying that Bevilier should come out and Cody Glass should come in, and then Bevilier ends up scoring that big goal and kind of getting them off to a good start. So I think it's just, I think you have to have a little bit of patience. And I know that sounds kind of counterintuitive in a 7-game playoff series, but I think if it's still a scoring or still an issue after game 3 where you're just not getting some depth scoring that you need, then maybe you think about putting Cody Glass in there. I don't know, but I don't think the answer right now is to switch the players. I think you just need the players that are out there to do their jobs and to actually do what they're paid to do.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't think that there's no one, at least offensively, who's currently not in the lineup who I think should be in place of anyone who's in there now. But I think that, yeah, maybe, I don't know, if you change up some combinations. I mean, the combination of Novak and Evangelista has been so effective earlier in the season. You know, they have really good chemistry, you know, really good playmaking ability, but it's just not happening so far in this series. And I don't know if the combination is maybe you move one of them. I mean, Brunette's tried that before and, you know, like, kind of moving them around. And again, I really don't know what the answer is there, but I think that it is hard. Like, both of these guys have, you know, they've never played in this Stanley Cup playoff series before. You know, they're new. Evangelista was really kind of riding high down the stretch of the regular season. He wasn't necessarily finding the score sheet as often as you would think based on how he was playing, but man, he was throwing.
And he played well in game one. I thought he played very well in game one.
Yeah, he did play very well in game one. And I think, you know, like, he's putting, I mean, he led everyone on both teams in shots on goal in game one. I mean, that's great. That's what you want. But I think that yeah, something's got to change there for them to kind of break out, because that line has really been invisible. And I would kind of point to that being as, I don't want to say the problem line in the sense that like that line is going to lose them games, but I think it's going to be the line that keeps them from winning games sometimes if they can't get something going offensively.
I think the only minor tweak that I would make is maybe switching Zucker and Jankowski. You put Zucker on the Novak Evangelista line. If those two can't figure it out, at least you have someone that can kind of sort of drive offense. Who, I mean, we've seen Jason Zucker, he's all over the place. So, I mean, maybe he could be a little bit of a spark for that line. And I think having someone who's just kind of very consistent with Jankowski on the Sissons and Bevilier line, that might be something to look at. But other than that, like Emma said, like, I wouldn't split up Novak and Evangelista just because they have played really well together. And yeah. I don't think the answer is splitting them up. Like, I don't think Evangelista is suddenly going to turn it on because you put him on a line with Colton Sisson. So,
and there's a very good chance that Novak snaps out of it when he's in his home building. You know, we'll see. Also, we got to give credit then, because as much as we're talking about those two lines not producing, well, Bevilier and Sissons both scored. So we do have to point out the third goal was basically a combination of Zucker, Bevilier, and Sissons crashing the net. Now, I will say the reason that they had that opportunity, which is important to be in the right place at the right time, but the reason they had that opportunity was the All-American beef line keeping the puck in the zone and then they go off for a change. They get a bad bounce and it happens to go back in the zone, and all of a sudden they're right there for it and they take advantage. Ford asked a question here about Roman Josi. He played 23 and a half minutes last night. McDonough was the only defenseman who played more. He says, I think Josi was hurt in the game, took a hard shot to the glass, and was hardly on the ice the rest of the game. Just hasn't felt like he was as much of a factor controlling the puck. I don't know if there's any. I thought he was out there plenty. I mean, almost 24 minutes. But I agree that they've done a good job, Vancouver has, of controlling his entry into the zone and keeping him from being an offensive factor.
Yeah, I think they've really, really neutralized him. I mean, you saw it in game one, too. And yeah, maybe midway through the second period of game two, I stopped even getting worried, as, you know, sad and heartless as that sounds. Like, I stopped getting worried when guys would block a shot and look slow to get up. I'd be like, oh shit. But then it's like, they were all doing it. And
it was the game plan.
That was the game. And, you know, again, it shouldn't be the series plan, but it was the game plan. And so, you know, I really didn't get all that nerve because, I mean, Josi took a shot that he was slow to get up. McDonough had a couple. Carrier blocked six shots, which, you know, nice redemption story after the goal he allowed in game one. But then, you know, like Zucker took one that he looked like he was slow to get up. And I just think that, you know, again, I'm not trying to downplay that at all or say that, you know, they're fine, you know, shake it off, rub some dirt on it, whatever. But I think that it comes with the territory, and that was the game plan.
Yeah, I'm sure they're probably hurting today and they're probably in the cold plunge and the ice baths and all that. And I also think, too, I'm not necessarily worried about Josi just because I feel like, I don't want to phrase this, I feel like Ryan McDonough has kind of taken over as kind of the guy who takes the shoulder of the defensive responsibility. Yeah. And that lets Josi kind of do what he does on offense. So I think he's fine. If he comes out in game three and he looks a little slow and he's not making plays and all that stuff, then maybe you worry. Maybe there is a little something to how banged up he is. But I think everybody's banged up at this point.
Yeah. And honestly, we just don't – coaching staff, media, fans, we don't have time to worry about Philip Forsberg and Roman Josi. We just don't. We got other things to worry about. You have to worry about power plays. You have to worry about taking bad penalties. You have to worry about UC Saros. You have to worry about, you know, Vancouver hitting an open net. You got to worry about a million other things. And
you didn't
so,
put Luke Shen in there. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, right. But again, like after the game one, people on social media, which is not real life, they're like, oh, Philip Forsberg. Well, Philip Forsberg. Okay, guys, game two. I don't have time to worry about Roman Josi. Him and McDonough have to be good. The top line has to be good to win. UC Saros was great in the third period. And here's the other thing. We can talk about how this is not a strategy to win the series. It is not. If they play the way they did in games one and two, the rest of the series, they will lose the series. And that's just I think that's just reality. But you also knew they had to steal one where they weren't the better team in Vancouver at some point. And they did that. They did that in game two. So if you come back, and I'm convincing you guys on this. If the Predators win game three based on like effort and work ethic, and they just grind out a win, the mental toughness of a Vancouver team that has never been here, and most of these players have never been here. Pettersson is clearly in his own head right now. It's clear. If they are down 2-1 going into Sunday's game, the mental toughness for Vancouver versus the mental toughness for the Nashville Predators, I think are on different plateaus. I think Nashville has a huge advantage if they can win game three, because clearly they did what they were like, look, we know we're not as good and we're going to do anything it takes to win game two. And they figured it out somehow, despite all the advanced analytics saying that Vancouver was, you know, clearly better and should have scored like four goals. They figured it out. They figured out a way, and Predators fans should be excited about that, because if they play their game and fix some of these problems in game three, I'm curious where this Vancouver team is mentally. That's all.
Yeah, I think, you know, it kind of goes back to a discussion that, I mean, we had and a lot of people were having before this series even started about how much does playoff experience matter, you know, coming into this, and how much you have as a team. And I truly believe that at the beginning of the series, you know, it is kind of a clean slate. It really doesn't matter. It's when you get into moments like this, like you're talking about, the mental toughness, you know, if you're down 2-1 and you know that you're the better team, that is when the playoff experience and, you know, that mental toughness, like you said, really comes into play. I don't think it's as important at the beginning of a series, clean slate, everything's fresh, but I think that, you know, like, again, doesn't always have to be pretty this time of year. We saw last night, it certainly wasn't for Nashville, but they got it done. And it's, you know, it's going to matter how much they can get it done. And I think of guys like, you know, you mentioned Ryan McDonagh, obviously, you know, has two Stanley Cups and he's been down this road plenty of times. I don't know if anyone else thought about this. I randomly thought about this during the game last night, that the season before he got traded to Nashville, when he was in the playoffs with Tampa, and that was the year that, like, it was after they got out of the playoffs, like after they were eliminated, it came out that like half the team was seriously injured like the entire time they were playing. And then I think McDonagh's injury in question was, and I quote, a mangled finger. Like, good Lord, like, why are you playing? Like, I'm not doing anything if I have a mangled body part. Are you kidding?
Hockey players, man. If you're a hockey player, get out there.
But that's my point, is that it takes that, you know, physical and mental toughness that, you know, like, comes with the territory of having this much playoff experience, and you know what it takes to work through it. And again, I think it's when you get into the meat of these series where that really comes into play.
And to Braden's earlier point too, if the Predators win game three, and then you're talking at that point that Besser and Miller and Pettersson and Hughes all still have not gotten the score sheet, I think that you're going to start to see the confidence kind of crumble a little bit. And to like what Emma said earlier, like, you can say what you want, playoff experience absolutely matters. The fact that the Predators have double the playoff experience that the Canucks do, I mean, we talked about the last time that they were in the playoffs was the bubble series. It's been 9 seasons before they played in front of their fans. I think we kind of saw a little bit of that last night. Yeah, game one, they came out and they didn't dominate, but they were clearly the better team, and they ended up winning. But I think that the playoff experience absolutely matters. And I say that because last night was a game that Vancouver should have won, but the Predators, we said, they found a way to gut it out. Ryan McDonagh, Luke Shen, Nyquist, all these guys that have been here, have been in the playoffs, that the guys that have won cups and all that. That's why Barry Trotz got these guys, to go out and win games that they probably shouldn't have won.
And look, because we're huge in BC now, shout out to all of our new Vancouver Canucks listeners and viewers that have been watching us. We do appreciate you guys. The fact that Canucks fans were watching our recap of game one and saying, hey, really good analysis. Like, hopefully you don't come to this show for like Homer talk. Like, that's the whole point of what we do here, is to tell you what we think, honestly. And so no higher compliment could be paid to me and to our show and to you two. If Canucks fans are like, hey, that was a really good show, really good analysis, et cetera, et cetera. And we do appreciate you guys. I'm saying all of that to say, y'all, seriously, reupholster your seats. Come on. Like, Like, you guys, I know you haven't been in the playoffs in a long time. You got a beautiful city. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth. Great. Come on, guys. Like, the seats. What are we doing?
We've gone from picking on jerseys to picking on stadiums now, I see.
God. This is the Twitter beef back and forth between Vancouver Canucks fans and Predators fans is hilarious to me. I'm enjoying it a lot. The purists of Canada and the non-traditionalists of Nashville going at it is actually great. I think it's great. It's great for the sport. It's wonderful, but come on, guys.
I'm just thankful we haven't heard the how many cups have you won kind of argument that Blackhawks and Penguins fans pull out. So kudos to you, Vancouver.
Joe says, is anyone still thinking about the size of Emma's coffee cup she drank out of earlier? You could plant a flower in that thing.
Hey, you know what? What you're talking about, you know, the back and forth between the fan bases being good for the game. You know what's not good for the game are these fucking 9 p.m. start times. Yeah, I hate it. So
we're back.
Had to do that. Had to do radio this morning in BC. So if you live in Kamloops and you heard me on the radio this morning, appreciate you for listening. But yes, I have.
Let me see that. Let's see that thing.
It's quite large.
That's not that. It's not that big. It's not that big, Joe. Settle down.
I just have small hands. We'll go with that. But yeah, and this is number one. It will not be my last one today.
You're only on. It's 9:42 a.m. Central Standard God's time, and you're on coffee cup number one.
I'm on very very large coffee cup number one. And
I'm on. This is number three.
Well, I've been sitting here talking to you guys this whole time. When am I going to get another one?
I haven't had coffee since I was 24.
Seriously?
Okay. Yeah. We get it, Michael. You're better than everyone else.
You hate you too.
And better, no. Tired, yes.
That's insane. Coffee is a miracle drug.
I don't hate you too. I'm just not a fan of you too.
Did you see it come up on the broadcast again? They can't help themselves. And it's kind of strange how, like, yes, I agree, Josh. Psycho behavior from Gallagher. it's serial killer behavior to not drink coffee after the age of 30. It is a miracle drug.
I'm hypersensitive to caffeine, so if I drink it, like, I'm literally throwing up an hour later. My body has a weird reaction to it. Well, so it's not because I don't want to drink it. It's because I literally can't.
We shouldn't shame you then, I guess. I can shame you for not liking you, too. But what's interesting is...
You will always shame people. You were shaming me for my messy kitchen in the photo I posted last
night. That was not messy. That was not about being messy. First of all, Twitter is now a space where you... I just love only Zoom-worthy photos. Like, I love a Zoom worthy photo where somebody posts a photo and the only thing I care about is what's in the background.
You were like, had razor sharp precision on some of that. Like, how the hell could you tell what kind of wine that was in my kitchen?
Did,
like,
I get it right? Was it actually a half block? Yes.
I thought you could tell. I'm like, it was.
No, that was a guess.
It was facing the other way. Like, you couldn't even see the label.
Look, I know how old you are. I know what kind of shoes you wear. I know what kind of coffee you drink, apparently, based on this picture. I took a stab at Sauv Blanc and I got it right.
Okay.
Maybe we should reach out and have them be a sponsor.
I mean, hey, I still drink. I have my Tim Hortons K-Cups every morning. So, you know, if Timmy's wants to come on and be a sponsor, that would be amazing. No, but I mean, the Hoka, yes. Okay. Maybe my body is older than my age. Because
I wasn't shaming you.
Yes, you were. I was a ballerina and I hated, you know, apparently just like destroyed my body at a very young age. So yes, I get shin splints when I run on a treadmill now. So I wear Hokas. So
I wear old man Brooks shoes when I work out. It's fine. I'm surprised I'm an old man. That's the difference.
Hey, I'm surprised with all the things that you saw in the background. I'm surprised you missed the Borowiecki family Christmas card on my fridge, because you can clearly see that in the
I did miss that. That's a huge miss by me. I do love like lurking on social media instead of posting. That's kind of what I do now, is I just lurk and look, and then I like to zoom in on people's photos.
Shame them.
It's only because you're you know, we work together on the show and I need.
You're starting to sound an awful lot like a Blackhawks fan, Braden.
Now that's too far. Okay.
That's like mean. To lurk on social media and shame people. That's literally Chicago Blackhawks fans.
Finally, we've reached the point in the show where Vancouver Canucks fans and Nashville Predators fans agree that is too far. No one wants to be a Chicago fan. So, all right, quickly around the NHL here, just a couple of observations. Watching the Caps and the Rangers and, you know, President's Trophy Laviolette, and he's coaching against his old team. And then the night before, the Islanders had a huge league against Carolina. Of course, Peter Laviolette's two other teams about to watch. The Predators, Peter Laviolette's other team. He's like, I don't know if he ever wins another cup. I don't know if the Rangers are good enough. I mean, I certainly have my own personal experiences with Peter Laviolette, but like, you probably can't write this chapter, this 25 years or whatever, without a pretty big chapter on Peter Laviolette. He's coached everywhere.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, though?
I don't know.
He keeps jumping teams, and he clearly has like a 4-year expiration date. So enjoy it, Rangers, because this is probably as good as it's going to get under Peter Laviolette.
He's got two more, right? He's got two more good ones.
From everything I've been told from a media standpoint, I got here to Nashville the beginning of the 22-23 season, and I have heard so many stories about Laviolette. He had already been gone for a couple years at that point, and I've been told, like, unprompted, oh man, you're lucky you missed the Laviolette days.
Well, he traumatized an entire fan base and an entire like conglomerate of media. Like, the dude was an asshole, and like, the only positive thing I remember from his tenure was when he put on the bullhead, and he that was the one time he showed off his personality. Other than that, like, he just instilled fear in everybody, because it's like, how dare you talk to the great, wonderful Peter Laviolette?
Yeah. What about the cup run? That didn't count for anything. What about going to the Stanley Cup final or winning a President's Trophy? No,
obviously that was great, but I'm talking about him in post game pressers, not about the on ice.
No, I know. I was at an event, actually, and I don't think I've ever told this story, so I'll bury it here in the 48-minute mark or whatever the show. Thank you guys all for listening and being hanging around with us. But
I'm going to clip this and tweet it out so people know about it.
I was at one of those like charity events preseason, you know, where they do – it's either like the Cashville thing where they're doing all the Vegas stuff. I think that might have been it. There might have been – I can't remember what it was.
Petey's Party is usually the preseason one.
Maybe that's what it was. But, like, Peter Laviolette's there with his wife, and I had kind of just started at 102.5, and this was, like, my first year covering hockey. And so I come in – I've already met with him in his office a number of times. Like, so he knew enough of, like, hey, this is the morning show host on our flagship station, and Jason Fitz was my co-host at the time, and so we'd met with him and Phil Housley and his coaching staff a few times. So, like, I assumed that this person at least – knows who I am in a weird way. I walk in and I introduce my wife is with me. So I assume that this is a non-sports sort of like personal situation, right? Like, we're not in sports mode here. You're not in like state secrets, nuclear codes. Don't tell him anything. We have to act abrasive kind of mode. Like, you're with your wife. I'm with my wife. We are here as doing charity work. Let's be cordial. And I said, hey, you know, hey, Peter, how are you? Braden Gall, good to see you again. This is my wife, Haley. And I'm not sure he said a single word to my wife. I'm not sure. He's like, hey. And that was, and like, then we just stood there and chatted with his wife for a second, walked away. And again, it's not that big of a deal. It's not that big of a story. But it's one of those moments where even my wife was like, yeah, he's kind of hard to talk to.
Okay. I was expecting, with the buildup to that story, I thought you were going to say he like, I don't know, cussed you out or something. No. That was kind of anticlimactic.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I just, the point. So if you guys don't know my wife is like the best listening, and obviously married to me, the best listener of any human I've ever met. Like, she's an empath who knows everybody's feelings at all times and is like the easiest human being to get along with, like literally the easiest human being to get along with. And even when she says something about a person that she's just met, 99.9% of the time it's like, yeah, that was great, that was fine. Like, but if she comes away from a first meeting and she's like, that was hard, that doesn't happen. So I guess I should put that context into this. So anyway, all right, Panarin, speaking of the Rangers, the Panarin hit on Oshie, I kind of think PK Subban's take on it is actually right. Like, it's clearly a hit to the head. If that was any other player, it would have been a penalty. I like old physical hockey. I think it's a great thing to watch. It's not great for the players. But it certainly felt like the NHL was pretty hypocritical with how they handled that with TJ Oshie and Artemi Panarin on Tuesday night.
Yeah, watching the replay of that, and I have it up on my other web browser right now, it almost seems like it looked like it was intentional, but I don't think it was meant to be as intentional as it looked, if that makes sense. Like, Panarin definitely loaded up and was going for a big hit, and I don't know if the closing speed was a little bit more than he thought. I don't know if he was closer to Oshie than he thought he was. I don't think he meant to hit him that hard, but he definitely loaded up on that shot, and like, that's a dangerous shot. Like, the dude, you clearly see Oshie's head snap back, and it's I'm at a loss for words. Somehow the NHL is just very inconsistent in what is acceptable for star players and what's acceptable for everyone that's like a mid-tier player. So if it wasn't Panarin, it probably would have been a fine or a suspension. But because it is, and he's very crucial to the New York Rangers and their playoff success, like they want to keep him on the ice, obviously. So
not even a penalty? You looked at it. Not even a penalty? What are we doing?
No, it's very clearly a penalty, and it should have been at least a one-game suspension, in my opinion. But, I mean, because he's one of the Rangers' stars, like, I'm not saying it's okay, but I understand why nothing happened because of who he is.
Yeah,
I would say the biggest issue for me is the no penalty, at the very least. Like, that's, again, I agree. I think you can, the load up, you know, and the hit was, it looked intentional. I don't think that he was necessarily aiming for his head. I don't know that that part was intentional. But when you come that far off the ground, it's going to happen, you know? And so, especially with Oshie's injury history too, again, it shouldn't matter. Like, it should be the same across the board, like with calling penalties and everything. But yeah, it's unfortunate. You have to believe that if it was, I don't know, any like Matt Rempe, like he would have gotten another suspension.
Also, if it was Ovechkin that got hit instead of Oshie, I think there would have been a lot more reaction to that, and there probably would have been a penalty too.
I think
for TJ Oshie, but
I think you're right. Oshie's almost as important though, like if not just as important. But I agree with you. I think if it was Ovi, they do that. What's interesting is, and the ref's jobs, like it's hard to legislate intent. It almost always is in any sport. But like your job as a referee, because you're on the ice, is to kind of pick up on things and to understand dynamics a little bit better than those of us at home. And the fact that those two had been going at it in the course of the game to then see what happened, like that's on the refs to understand that there's more to it than just, oh, this was an accidental hit to the head. Like it was, to your point, it was clearly intentional because of how the game was playing out. He had a chance to take a big shot. He did it. I agree. He maybe wasn't trying to hit him in the head, but he sure as hell was trying to hit the shit out of him. So I don't know. I can't believe it's not a penalty. It is what it is. I'm torn because as an old hockey guy, I like the physicality in the game, but I also want to protect the player. So I'm kind of balanced on that. Lastly here, what about the Mark Stone thing? And we'll get a prediction on game 3 coming up, but or what you want to see. But for those that don't understand, Vegas kind of finagled the salary cap last year but again, totally legally, right? Put Mark Stone on long-term IR last year because of some back surgery, I believe, didn't play a big chunk of the season. And then because your salary cap doesn't apply in the playoffs, which NHL, hello, you could fix that loophole if you want to. He just sort of comes back onto the team to start the postseason again this year, just like he did last year. He scores, he gets booed every single time he touches the puck by the Dallas fans, rightly so. But at the end of the day, this is Vegas, in my opinion. I don't know how you guys feel about this. This is on the NHL. If I'm Vegas, if it's in the rules, do it. If I'm the Predators and I could have a player on long-term IR and then go over the cap to have that player in the playoffs, but it's inside the framework of the rules. Go for it. Dallas, you can boo all you want to, but it's in the rule book, man.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, and I wrote about this for heavy.com earlier this week, that I think it's 100% it's on the league. I mean, they could easily fix this, easily change it. You know, I have to tip my hat to Kelly McCrimmon for being able to do this. And not just, I think the bigger piece here is not only did you have Stone on IR and then, you know, bring him back for the playoffs 2 years in a row, it was while he was on IR because of his huge cap hit. He was able to bring in key pieces at the trade deadline. This year it was Hertl and Hanifin, Anthony Mantha. So not only did he, you know, kind of, I don't know, but like finesse the cap, but he used that space and he filled every bit of it to actually make the team better at the deadline. And so we've seen that. And then of course Stone comes back, scores a power play goal in his first game back. And
his first shift.
Oh yeah. He had one shot the entire game and it was a goal. And I think that it was just like, it's definitely on the league. I think what I have seen a lot of, and this I don't necessarily agree with, is people on social media and wherever. And it got so bad to the point where, where this was actually addressed in Kelly McCrimmon's press conference he had a couple of days ago about, you know, people saying or alleging that they had made up Stone's injury or like tried to make it sound more severe than it was. And I'm like, you know, by, you know, to kind of get him on LTIR. But what I think was,
it almost cost him a playoff spot. So if that's the case, if they were doing that, it almost cost them the playoffs.
But also, I mean, McCrimmon brought up a good point that when you put a guy on LTIR, that's not just a team decision. The NHL is involved in that. Like the NHL has to have the final say, and they can't just say, you can't just say like, oh, Roman Josi is banged up, so we're going to put him on LTIR. Like, no, it has to be, you know, there has to be first opinions and second opinions and third opinions, and all the medical evidence has to go to the league and it has to get approved and reviewed. And so I think that, you know, I mean, the man had a lacerated spleen. Like, I don't really, I'm not a doctor, but that doesn't sound good. Like,
no, I don't think there was any tomfoolery, but like NHL, fix the rules.
Which also, I think it's kind of ironic to point out that he lacerated his spleen in a game against the Nashville Predators earlier this year. But yeah, no, I think that's the one thing I would like to squash are just the people who are saying that, he's faking it. He literally can't. Like, you can't fake an injury like that.
I look at what Vegas does with LTIR, kind of like what the Eagles do with the tush push. Everybody has the opportunity to do it. Vegas is just better at it than everybody else, and it's legal. So as long as it's legal, quit bitching about it.
Well, and they happen to have a guy who gets hurt all the time who also happens to be very good in the playoffs. Like, it's and costs a lot of money. It's just, it's a very random situation.
I do think it's funny. My buddy Kyle sent me a screenshot of Cap Friendly's transactions with Vegas and Mark Stone. And from February 14th, 2022 until April 22nd, 2024, Vegas put him on injured reserve and moved him to LTIR and then activated him around the playoffs like 8 times.
Matt says it's on the NHL, but it ain't gonna make me like Vegas any better. The question is, who is more unlikable, the Dallas Stars or the Vegas Knights? Because I think for Preds fans, I think it's still Dallas.
You can't not like another team more than a division rival. I just don't understand that.
Of course, last here, well, before we ask you guys about game three, Connor McDavid, 5 assists in the playoffs. I think Edmonton is on a warpath. That's just my thoughts. These elite superstar players that are the greatest of all time, they don't normally go without cups, you know, like normally they get one. I don't know if that's this year, but I think I said Edmonton, Dallas in the Western Conference final. I feel better about Edmonton than I do about Dallas. Okay. Game three, real quickly, we'll wrap up with this. Thank you guys for the comments. Of course, find Emma Lingen at Emma_Lingen on twitter.com. By the way, Twitter is not for conversations by adults. It is for zooming in and seeing people's kitchens. That is what Twitter is for. It's not for a conversation. Michael, of course, you can get to him at MGSports_. And you can find their work at Nashville Hockey Now for Michael and the Hockey News for Emma. All right. What do you expect in game three? What do you expect to see? We'll be back, by the way, Saturday morning at a much better start time because it's a 6:30 puck drop on Friday evening at the Stone.
I expect to see a much more complete performance getting in front of your home fans. I mean, mid-season, they were one of the worst home teams, and they figured it out. They were 23-16-2 at home, which ended up being probably right on par with what they were away. And we talked about how good of a road team they were. I would expect to see more of what we saw down the stretch than we did, like, as opposed to like game one and game two. Vancouver, I still think, is the better team. I still think they're better at executing this kind of system, but I think being in front of the home, fans, and we all know how loud Bridgestone Arena can get in the playoffs. I mean, we saw how it carried them to a cup final, but it was a big factor in it. So I think there's just something different about Bridgestone Arena in the postseason than there is at any point in the regular season, regardless of what's going on. And I think that they really feed off that. And I think that the players and Andrew Burnett are also kind of buying into that, hyping it up. Like, look, we have some of the best fans in the league. You know, we don't know when we're going to get back here. Burnett said getting to the postseason is hard. You don't know how many times you're going to be able to get back. I think they kind of feed off that. And I expect a more complete performance. And I would expect another close game, like a 3-2 win for the Preds, maybe.
Yeah, I think it'll be close. I would like to see a more complete effort, particularly on offense. I think that the home crowd will will definitely play a factor, because, I mean, you're talking about how loud Bridgestone is during the postseason. I really, even just watching it on TV, I have to give credit to the crowd at Rogers Arena. I mean, they were incredibly loud. And I think it was, I can't remember if it was JT Miller or Brock Best. I think it was JT Miller. I watched an interview with him where he said that he almost got emotional by like coming out there and seeing how loud it was. And so that certainly has an effect. And, you know, I think that it's not going to be easy. I think the Canucks are going to come into game three really pissed off because they know they should have won game two. And I think, you know, they're going to have their work cut out for them. But I think I agree. I think it's going to be it's going to be close.
I think it's the entire series is close. I think what matters the most here is the first period. This is the best first period team in the NHL, Vancouver, and Nashville has a 1-0 lead in both of the first periods in each of game one and game two. If they can do that again, then I think it bodes well for how that razor's edge that Vancouver could be walking as the game is. If the game goes along and it's 1-0, 2-1, and the longer the Preds have the lead at home, I think the more that mental toughness is a question for Vancouver. If they come out like a buzzsaw like they did in all of the first, basically last four periods of hockey, and they take a lead, I think Vancouver wins pretty easily. So I think that first period's a big one. Keep an eye on that. So otherwise, that about does it. I appreciate all you guys in the comment section, all you folks who are watching across all the platforms, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. Please share the product, of course. It'll be up on the podcast feed here shortly. So give us a review, give us a rating there. Even if you're a Canucks fan, we'll take it, you know. But if you do not give us a 5-star rating, you are a hater. For Michael and Emma, I am Braden Gall. Thank you guys for listening and hanging out. Enjoy game three. We will talk to you guys afterward on Saturday morning.